Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on pediatrics.
My name is Alice Bass. I'm a nurse practitioner with the palliative care program or the advanced illness management team at Nationwide Children's Hospital. And here to sort of be the moderator for these lovely folks, not that I think they even need it, but to start sort of our first ever briefed parents panel for the fellowship curriculum. And so one of the things that, you know, we were hoping that you guys would be able to get out of this panel is to be able to describe why parents must feel they have done everything when their child faces a life-threatening condition. Be able to describe the differences in grief experienced by a parent compared to the grief felt by a person who loses a parent or a life partner, because I think that those experiences are very different. And who I have today, three very lovely sets of parents with very awesome, lovely children that are here to bravely tell their story and share their journey with you guys. Okay, and we have Aaron and Rachel Lewis, whose son is Keith, Janice Schroeder, son is Lucas Schroeder, and then Jeremy Cole, whose son's name is Gavin. And I invite you guys to ask questions as needed. I want this to be informal, and I think that they prefer it that way too. If you guys have questions, raise your hand, ask as they're sharing their story, and hopefully you guys will learn quite a bit, because they all have wonderful, amazing stories, and their journeys took them in very different places. Okay, so we'll start first with Keith, if that's okay. What I was going to have each of you do is maybe go through and share a little bit about your journey, your son's journeys, and how your family had gone through learning about diagnosis, and anything else you want to share sort of moving forward. Okay.
Yeah, I'll start off just introduce myself, Aaron Lewis. Rachel's going to give the background story on Keith, but I want to add to her comment about we signed up for this to give you guys a complete open forum. I'll speak first, so I'm speaking for them too, but no questions off the table. This is why we're here, so you guys have a safe place to ask parents questions of things that are on your mind, things that you're, you know, too scared to ask other parents or just have thought about it for a long time but don't know who to ask. Like, this is why we're here. We signed up for this. So please, any question, and we prefer questions. So I'll let Rachel do the story on Keith.
I'm Rachel Lewis. Keith Lewis is our son. So he passed away when he was about 6 months old in the hospital at Nationwide Children's. We knew when he was first born he had a couple things that were off, but we didn't expect it to be anything that would be life-threatening. Around 3 months of age, he was really having trouble feeding. So we were admitted to the hospital. He had actually started to lose a little bit of weight. So we were admitted to a general peds floor at Nationwide Children's. That's where he got the NJ tube. And that was life-saving in that moment. That really helped us. And then we started doing things like chest x-rays and genetic panels. We found out that he had the walls of his heart were thickening. And during that stay in General Peds is when we first came in contact with the AIM team at Children's. And we were basically told then that this would likely be something that would end Keith's life. So that was when he was 3 months old is when we were starting to open that door that maybe he wasn't going to live very long. We actually didn't get a diagnosis for Keith until about a year and a half after he passed away. We had done a number of genetic panels that were all coming back normal when he was here. It was with Baylor University, so they had his DNA. And the genetics team at Children's came back and said, hey, they still have his DNA. Do you want us to rerun it? Maybe they have found something else. So they reran it and found that he had a mitochondrial disorder, which we knew clinically while we were in the hospital. His body was having trouble just accepting feeds, knowing how to breathe, calming himself down, things like that. So we knew during the end of life care what was going on, but then we got that official diagnosis much later. Yeah, so he passed away. We got readmitted to the hospital through the emergency room after a breathing episode, and we were in the cardiothoracic ICU at Nationwide Children's because of the known heart condition. We ended up on that floor. We were there for about a month before he passed away there.
I'm Janice Schroeder. And I have three children. I am a pediatric nurse of 28 years. And my Luke, our Luke, this is the first time I've done this, so I'm a little raw, a little fresh. Our Luke, total healthy growing, but at birth I knew there were issues, but we go back and forth to the doctor. Just, he was normal enough and he thrived enough that they didn't go forward with stuff because he was rotten and crazy. He was my Jerry Lewis, my Tim Conway. And it wasn't until he turned 16 in June 3rd last year, fell, hit his head in the middle of the night, went down the hallway, found him with agonal respirators out of the blue. He was totally fine the evening before. Had to have a brain surgery 24 hours later, and that began our nightmare. Never knew what was going on, thought the whole time it was encephalitis. He spent a month, first time in the hospital, all of June last year. And it just continued. And then the seizures came. By August 10th, he was not an epileptic. By August 11th, he was an epileptic with intractable seizures. That they just started rolling and just kept going. Again, been a nurse for 28 years. And I'm like, what in the world? Wonderful physicians, great care. In and out of the hospital, August, October, and we go in November, he couldn't walk. And it was just those seizures. They were just seizures. But he would, and other people, other trained professionals, couldn't even recognize the seizures because they were so subtle. And all he would do is all of a sudden he'd start drooling. And you're like, hey, Luke, smile at me. And his face, when he'd drool, he'd look like a stroke victim. I'm like, hey, dude, you okay? And they'd last 30, 40 seconds. So literally, if you weren't staring at the kid, you didn't know what happened. And he was just a happy-go-lucky kid. He never complained. He never raised his hand to let me know what's happening. You know, you all right, Luke? You know, he never complained. So November 12th, at a restaurant, and he couldn't eat his dinner. I finally looked at him. I said, Luke, I need you to spit out your shrimp. He's like, he's mad. He's upset with me. He puts his fork down, spits it out because he can't chew. He can't swallow. I'm like, Duke, you're gonna choke on shrimp, buddy. And he's like, I'm hungry. I'm like, I know, bub. And that was actually his last meal. And actually, we giggle now because he had to spit out his shrimp. And so we spent November to January 25th with Luke in the hospital. On January 24th, we found out after four biopsies of his brain, a bone flap, and a whole bunch of other testing, that it was gliomatosis cerebri. Extremely rare, maybe 100 people a year in North America will die a year. So there's not any research, there's no funding. No one knows what gliomatosis looks like at the beginning. And now they believe it looks a lot like encephalitis. So we did not know all along that Luke was leaving us. We feel blessed because we had 8 months with him and not 8 weeks. Had they known it was gliomatosis at the beginning, they would never have done a bone flap to allow his brain to excel past the borders. He would never have been given that option. Never in a million years imagined the hospital I work with would be the place that I would actually say goodbye to my child. But, I'm totally forever changed, but hopefully more compassionate than I've ever been. And again, just like they said, we wanted to come here to tell you so that the next Luke and the next Keith and the next baby is that as you enter those rooms that it makes a difference. Because we've got to make sense of why they came and were with us for whatever time they were with us. So if you'll forgive my tears, please feel free to ask any question.
Good morning. My name is Jeremy Cole, and I buried my 17-month-old son, Gavin, in January of 2014. Up until that point, he was... you know, an 11-month-old, you know, before his diagnosis, he was an 11-month-old, happy, fun-loving, adorable little boy. And, you know, the beginning of July 2013, we noticed some things that were going wrong. He wouldn't eat. He was throwing up everything every time he fed. And so my wife and I found out on July 15th of 2013, that Gavin had a tumor which was going to take him from us. The tumor was ATRT. It's atypical teratoid rhabdoid tumor. And Lord help me, I wish I never knew what that stood for. We found out on July 15, 2013, which, you know, we just passed the fifth anniversary on Monday. And 6 months later, he was gone. You know, we made a lot of good memories in those 6 months. But as his time wound down, a couple of things became glaringly evident. Number one, my son was going to die, and there was nothing I could do to stop it. Number two, my wife and I were not prepared to lead our two older children through the experience because we were not all right ourselves. You know, think about that for a second. How do I guide my children through this experience when I can't square myself away emotionally? That was my nightmare within the nightmare. I swear it kept me up at nights. So we, you know, we get home from the hospital, and same day we get home from Children's, there's a knock at the door, and in walks the palliative care team. Now, we had met with Barb Dreheim at the hospital, and she kind of gave us a rundown of what to expect, but, you know, there's the palliative care team, and they walk in our door, and never met them, didn't know them. They sat us down and asked us what we had going on, and so we told them. And without hesitation, they said, all right, you go handle your family. We've got this. And I almost kind of laughed. You know, you got this. You got what? What does that even mean, you got this? I can tell you, at the darkest moment in my family's existence, this palliative care team grabbed us by the hand and said, you handle that, we got this. They were family to us the moment they walked in our door. That's what you all are going into. The loss of your child is a catastrophic event. No way getting around that. And while Gavin's passing is and always will be a significant moment in my family's timeline, the palliative care team that we engaged with ensured that it was not the defining moment of my family's history. That's what our experience with our palliative care team was. That's what you all are doing here today. So just to piggyback on exactly what has been said already, that's why I'm sitting here today. That's why we sign up for this, is that team gave my family so much that sitting here, and it is my honor to do whatever I can to give back to that community so that you can help that next family.
Thanks, guys, for sharing your stories. I know it's not easy. I know Jeremy spoke a little bit about palliative care, and for us, at least in the pediatric world, when we meet families, a lot of times they've never even heard about the term palliative care before, and we sort of set the stage for them by explaining sort of what our role is. If you guys could think back to the first time you met us, can you maybe share a little bit about what your definition or how you thought palliative care was or meant before meeting our team, and then maybe if you can think back to the first time you met someone from the palliative care team, sort of what your impression was, and then how it might have evolved over the course of your hospitalization or over the course of your child's life.
So my previous experience with palliative care was zero, minus what I've heard from Rachel, and she'll share her story. But, you know, my experience with death in my family was grandparents, great-grandparents who were 91, not local, you know, in Iowa, or, you know, one got, you know, in a car wreck. So I never had dealt with anything with palliative care, and, you know, had heard the term, probably not even heard the term palliative care, heard the term hospice care, but was, so my history was zero. My, you know, first experience, you know, when palliative care team came in was, you know, to me it was kind of like, you know, oh boy, this is kind of serious, you know, like this could be serious. And I think it really started conversations between her and I about what could happen. Not like this is definitely going to happen, because we didn't know. We went through so many tests in November. It was like testing for, what was the Duke one? Pompeii disease. I think it's Pompeii disease. You know, we're going to send this test out to Duke. It's like, no, it's not Pompeii disease. Test for this. No, it's not that. So we really had no idea what was going on. But, you know, I talked to, you know, Dr. Norwitz. One of this quote that's in my mind from a conversation with him was, you know, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. You know, that got us starting conversations, you know, even in November, before we had any idea or any expectation that Keith wouldn't live beyond a year. Was like, you know, what would we want for a funeral? Well, we don't want a funeral. We want a celebration of life service. And where would he be buried? Conversations that you shouldn't be having as parents of a 3-month-old. But it just kind of, you know, got us talking about stuff. Like, but hey, if something did happen, what would we do, and how would we handle stuff? So I think it really opened up conversations between her and I. But, you know, previous to that, my experience was zero. So
mine's a little bit different. So I was introduced to palliative care probably in my early 20s, when my grandmother suffered from a severe stroke and ended up on the palliative floor at Mount Carmel. I had no idea what palliative meant. I was introduced to that term and what that meant for her. So then my mother passed away in my mid-20s, actually at the old Kobacker house. So I was with her when she passed away. So I was her primary caregiver, but I was oddly comfortable with death. I thought that it was supposed to be this beautiful process. That's what I had seen. So when we were introduced to it, of course, it was devastating, but we are preparers. We're deliberative. We want all the information. We want to know what everything's going to look like. So like he mentioned, it really, in a time where we thought this was not Keith's path, it really forced us to think that maybe it was. And we did need to start having conversations about his care, about what, if he did pass away, what that would look like, the end of life moments and afterwards with a funeral or celebration of life. So being introduced to the team there when Keith was 3 months old, at first felt like too much. We didn't know what his diagnosis was. We didn't know what his path was. So I would say I was a little bit more resistant to accepting them coming to talk to us. But thankfully, we had medical staff that understood that Keith was potentially very sick, and it was the right time to introduce that team to us and start having those conversations. And then they continued to walk with us through the entire journey and until Keith passed away. So it was very beneficial.
My experience with palliative care and hospice, I've known about it my whole career, never had to go be up close and personal with the team. And ours has kind of morphed a little bit at Children's. We call it the Advanced Illness Management Team. So we get introduced to them a little earlier. Well, I'd heard of the AIM team, but I always expected them just to be the hospice group. And when they were first introduced to me as mom, I'm like, we're not there yet. I was like, we're not there yet. Our docs are still talking hope. Why are you having this conversation with me? But I can tell you, I can honestly tell you that I was having these conversations in my head well before my husband ever did. And he's not medically inclined, you know. So I knew what a trach, an event, looks like down the road. I know when that occurs in the lifespan. So I knew, but I was not, I cannot say I was resistant. And at one point, my husband, I giggle now because one day, it was just a bad day for him. I don't know if he was tired. He had to spend the night. AIM team came in, and it was one of our team members. He was one of the kindest people on earth. And my husband was stewing on the bed. He just not talkative. And he's a pastor. He's a good guy. He just, and finally, Lisa had said to him, "You want to talk about it?" He says, "No, I don't want to talk about anything, actually." She goes, "Okay, it's okay." And it made me giggle because my husband's so forthright. And I'm like, "Babe," but it's just where he was. So at the beginning, you will get resistance, no matter, because they don't teach you how to say goodbye. And it isn't something we should have to do as adults, as parents, to bear your child. So you will get resistance. And it's not personal. To them it is. To the person who's saying goodbye it is. But it's not. You will press through that. And you have to. Because we don't know how to say goodbye. I've been trained to deal with death and dying every day. And I still wasn't prepared enough. So I appreciate where you're going and what you're doing, but you'll just have to persevere through that first initial. And it's probably going to come from the mothers more than the dads. I'm just saying.
I fall into the category with Aaron. Prior to our son's situation, I had heard of hospice, but that was something that was, you know, for lack of a better term, something that you dealt with when you were 80, you know, that was something I was prepared to engage with my parents. Hospice, when the term hospice started getting thrown around with my 11-month-old son, I'm confused at that point. Up to that point, palliative, I didn't know how to spell it. I didn't know what it meant. it kept getting used, and I didn't understand what it was. But we got a quick education. We learned quickly on the fly, and I'm not trying to oversell it. When that team, you know, Dr. Winters and all the nurses, when they walked in our door. We took our son home because the diagnosis was such that even with the most aggressive treatment, he had a 10% chance of survival. And we made the decision, and they helped us make the decision, but we made the decision that, you know, whatever time he had left was going to be spent at home with us, that we were not going to put him through chemo and radiation and all of that treatment for what would equate to 10 more minutes in the grand scheme of life. You know, that would have been 10 more minutes for us to put him through that kind of pain and suffering that you can't explain to a 12-month-old and he doesn't understand. We made the decision that whatever time he had left was going to be at home with us. And they walked in our door and they walked us through the process and held our hand at every moment. And, it goes without saying, it's not something that anybody considers. You don't know how to go through that process. You don't even know what you don't know. You don't even know what questions to ask. And they are honestly angels walking on this earth. That's the best way I can put it. You know, once the process, you know, once Gavin passed and, you know, you're in the program for 2 years afterward, once we got out of that program and they, you know, ceased being our caregivers, I have every one of their cell phone numbers in my phone right now. We still meet them out for coffee or whatnot. My wife's still Facebook friends with them all. They will forever be involved in our lives. Most of them have moved on from Children's Hospice and Palliative Care team into other areas now. A couple of them remain behind, but most of them have moved into other positions. They will always be part of our lives because not to over-exaggerate, we love them as people.
So I'm Jonathan again, and I appreciate you guys being up here and talking with us. And Janice, you know, your story kind of resonates in what I would only imagine to be the case when you guys as parents hear, you know, the words palliative hospice and are being introduced to this. And I can only imagine that it's always in a sense going to feel too soon. But after the fact, looking back now, do you guys have any feelings on knowing what you know that you wish that maybe you had met them sooner or had met them later?
Obviously, death is an extremely personal and vulnerable position. And the sooner I had watched, you know, I'm doubly blessed in that I got to know the team before I knew the team. I've seen them flitter around the building many, many times, but I never knew them. Anytime there's an advanced illness, anytime a child is, in my opinion, heading in that direction, anytime a child gets a tracheostomy, I'm sorry, that is right there enough for a consult for an AIM team or a palliative, you know, I love that we call it AIM team because you build relationships with them. And when you're going down the most vulnerable path you've ever been in your life, and you just feel so exposed emotionally. Yes, the sooner they're introduced to the family, the better, in my opinion. Because you're going to have bonds with them that you will not make with other humans in this lifetime. Because they will navigate you through the goodbye. I knew some of the process because I help other families with that process on a regular basis. I knew what happened after the last breath. After we put a time of death down on a certificate. I know that process because I help aid in that process. But you don't know how to say goodbye right before the last breath. And what AIM team does is they come in, we talk about it and tell you how it's okay. Whatever you do is okay. However way you say goodbye, however way you want to do it. My son was 6'3", and they're like, do you want to hold him? I said, are you kidding me? How are we going to get him out with that tracheostomy out of that bed? Are you kidding me? And they're like, do you want to be up there with him? I'm like, no, because he would be grossed out. He's 17 now. He would like, mom, no. You know, and I can laugh about that because Luke had such an amazingly funny, hysterical personality. I knew him that way because I had him longer than these sweet people. So yes, bringing them in earlier, I think is important. Letting them know, hi, I'm here. I'm here. I'm the AIM team group. I'm the whatever you're called in your department. I'm going to be with you no matter where you go through this, navigate through the hospitalizations, through the illness. And like I didn't finish earlier, we didn't know till the last day. So 24th of January this year, we found out it was the gliomatosis cerebri. My husband said, stop, stop. There's nothing else, stop. And we took everything off and he died the next day. So we had one day, whereas people, we'd known it was cancer all along, I think we would have entertained the thoughts of death and dying all along, but we didn't have that. The whole time we were thinking it was curable and treatable and going to be okay. So for us, for my teenager, yes, an earlier introduction would have been better for my husband and I, because I was like, no, I'm not ready yet. No. Why are you calling them? We haven't discussed this. It's midnight. I'm literally, why are we having this discussion at midnight with who's not my physician? Why? So, and again, it was a very well-meaning attending who's so sweet. I love her to death. But literally, she saw me in passing because I'm an employee. Hey, Janice, have they got into AIM team in? I'm like, no, 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 not yet. So that conversation should be
being occurring with people that they know, not just a happenstance conversation in a hallway with, hey, I'm your first team member. We're going to talk about death and dying today. No, it doesn't go like that. Or, you might come in the room and they might go, what are you saying? My kid's going to die? Let's talk about that. How you feel about that? What do you think? Are you afraid of them dying? And I get called in as a supervisor because they're ranting and raving because they are afraid on days that they are not dying. And I'm like, I see you're scared. You are scared. Okay, let's talk about that. How do you feel? And of course, that conversation's a little different now after my own.
I don't think it was pretty early on in our stay. I think I can't remember exactly when in that November month time frame that they kind of came in. You know, it was a little bit shocking at first, but you know, the conversation of it's not, you know, hospice care, right? It's called AIMS team or advanced illness. And there's a lot of stuff going on with Keith. We're finding a lot of different things, the left vent hypertrophy. And, you know, we're not sure what that means, but that's, you know, pretty serious. And we'll have to monitor that going on. When we left Thanksgiving, it was, hey, he's on a feeding tube. He's doing well. I pushed a lot of people and the AIMS team, like, is there any reason you think he won't live past a year? And everyone at that point was like, no, I don't think so. You know, we left in December. We had a really good December with him at home. We had a ton of follow-ups over, neurology and development stuff and the feeding side and GI and all that stuff. But, you know, I think what the AIMS team really helped us think about initially was what quality of life meant for us and what our desire is for quality of life for Keith. As we transitioned through this journey, not having no idea where it was going, having no expectation that he would be gone by February, but just as we go through this journey with him, you know, what is quality of life? How do we define quality of life for our son? And that's completely different than everybody else. But that allowed us to have those conversations, and having those conversations before anything really serious even happened, you know, I think made our decision-making process in January much easier, and certainly that we always knew we were on the same page because we had conversations that I think were initiated by conversations with the AIMS team. And that was really important for us. And so many people, nurse staff, gave us feedback like, you know, decisions you make for Keith, you guys are, you know, they always on the same page, and we can tell you're making these decisions because of your love for Keith, and they could see that. But that was because we have had these conversations before. It wasn't just like in the moment where, you know, no, we need to pull him off, you know, we're extubating, you know, what do we want? What does that mean for us? You know, we weren't making those decisions and having those conversations in those moments because we've had them long before we had any expectation that we might be burying him. So I think that was, you know, probably one of my most positive experiences with the AIMS team in November before anything was serious was, what does quality of life mean for you? And starting to think about that stuff. And that led to other conversations, like in the middle of the night, you know, like about funerals and stuff. Like, well, we shouldn't have this conversation. I hope we don't get here. But if we do, what would we do?
And I just want to touch, too, on the quality of life conversation. When they were introduced to us when Keith was about 3 months old, it did feel a little bit early to me because we just didn't know what was going on. They did tell us that, you know, we don't think that there would be any reason why he would pass away before his first birthday, but we don't know what's going on. So I just want to reiterate that it did spark those conversations. And although it felt early at that time, it actually was more comfortable when they then came in January when he was 5 months old, and we were really having to have those conversations because we came in a critical situation. He was put on life support, so now we really did need to have those conversations. He needs assistance right now to live, so what does this look like going forward? And the quality of life conversations really happened. So, you know, they were softly introduced to us at 3 months, and then when we really needed them at 5 months, it felt that much more comfortable to have them there.
Yeah, oh, there's Alice. I remember her. Yeah.
I guess it sounds like our experience was a little different. We were informed that we were going to lose Gavin before we met with the AIM team. So by the time they were brought into us, and we're just talking about like maybe the next day, by the time they were brought in to meet with us, we already knew where our train was going. I'll say this. I'm personally big on deferring to professions. I'm an accountant. I could do your taxes for you, but I'm not going to work on your teeth. I don't ask my dentist to work on my car. I wouldn't ask my mechanic to do my taxes. Make sense? You all are going to experience families react to the news that there's an advanced illness, potentially life-threatening, with their children in different ways. To be honest with you, my first inclination was to circle the wagons, to go inward. We're going to deal with this as a family, and I don't want to hear from anybody. Lord help me, what an awful situation that would have ended up in. And it's just one of those things where I didn't know. And so, to directly answer your question, we as parents, and I'm not medically inclined, so I have to defer to you all in the medical profession to assess the situation and make the determination of what the right time to introduce that team and that subject to the families are. And don't hesitate. Earlier is probably better. You're going to meet resistance. You're going to meet resistance from somebody who thinks, wait a minute, we haven't checked all the boxes. We haven't crossed, you know, all the T's. Why are we having this conversation already? You're going to meet that. Understand you're going to meet that. But you have to make your best judgment for that family because this is your profession. This is your world. I know in today's medical community, the inclination is to involve families in their own medical care, and that's great. But the reality is, I don't know. And so if you're asking me when the right time is to introduce this very important piece to the puzzle, I'm going to screw it up. I guarantee you 100% of the time I'm going to muck it. I'll give you an example. About 2 months before Gavin passed, Thanksgiving of 2013, he took a real deep decline. That was the turning point. It was that Thanksgiving week. And he went from looking like that to looking like it could be any day, in a hurry. And I looked at my wife and I said, we have to tell, you know, at that time, we had a six and a 5 year old, and they didn't quite understand what was going on, but they can observe that something's not right. And I told her, we got to tell them that Gavin's not going to make it. And we went through, you know, we had a child life specialist who was, you know, coming in and talking to them, and we bounced it off to, you know, I called her and just said, you know, hey, it's time. I'm going to tell them. And she said, whoa, wait a second here. Children don't have concept of timelines. If you take your children and you tell them today that Gavin's going to pass away, they think it's going to happen tomorrow. They don't understand that it's going to happen in the future. They think it's going to happen tomorrow. You have to do X, Y, Z. You have to work up to that. And so in that context, she saved me from making a significant error in caring for my children. So the introduction of that team to the parents may not feel like the right time for them, but you all, we rely upon you all to know when the right time is.
Good question. Yeah. Cheers.
Anybody have any other questions you'd like to ask? If not, I'll throw one in. So I've had conversations with some of you guys individually about this in the past, and I've heard you speak to it before, and I think it's really important to hear. What kinds of things or styles of communication did you find helpful as you coped with new diagnosis or new potentially devastating information? Because I know that, you know, we talk a lot about how two people in the same room receiving the same information might react differently. Could you share a little bit more about your styles?
Yeah, you may have noticed already, but our styles are very different. You know, I tell when we do the nursing education course, you know, it's a definite strong point that we that I like to share is that, you know, you need to be able to read people. And, you know, that's not something you're learning in med school or you can really learn from any book. But, you need to have a kind of that sense of being able to read people of when you walk in the room, you know, you can probably read that I'm, you know, you might be able to joke with me about something, have a conversation with me that you may not have with Rachel. Just in between our family, there's strong differences. But there's days where I may not want that either. You know, so it's really that somehow building that ability to read people. And I always say there are people who you will work with who have been doing this for a long time who just are great at it. You know, ask who those people are. You'll see who those people are and just, you know, shadow them and learn from them. Because I think that's a critical skill that has nothing to do with your ability to, you know, take care of the family or Keith, you know, medically. But it's a really important skill, and especially in the world of palliative care and dealing with the sensitive issues that you're dealing with. You know, being able to read when to have what conversation, when, how you can talk to families. So something that was very important to us was having those relationships with the staff, because we lived in the hospital for 2 months, all of November, all of January. We slept there every night. You know, so we were they are our family. They certainly were our family. And, you know, we learned personal things about them. And that really helped to build those relationships when we did have to have those hard conversations, or when the staff did say, we don't know what's going on with Keith. You know, because I had, you know, three, you know, conversations about their family or their kids, you know, that builds trust and comfort when they're saying, I don't know what's going on with your son. When some people might say, you're the doctor, you need to know. I expect you know, this is why I'm here, right? But Keith's situation was very complex, and it was a giant mystery for a long time. You know, so certainly being able to, you know, read people and how to deal with different people, you know, kind of differently.
Something that was important to me was something as simple as body language, and tone, and how you chose to talk with us. So a lot of times doctors would come into the room, we'd be tired, we'd be sitting on the couch, they would talk over us, talk down to us, rush through information. It was all overwhelming anyway. So, you know, when people would come in and communicate to us that way, it was just a little bit more difficult to connect to them. But we had physicians who would come in, they would sit down on our couch in the room or sit down in the chair. They would ask us how we're doing. They would talk through things. You know, they would let us ask however many questions we needed to ask. So something I got pretty tired of pretty quickly were, and we just got to know the staff that would do this, they would walk into the room and they would kind of have that puppy dog face, sad puppy dog face, we call it, where, you know, they're coming in and they're like, oh, how are you doing today? I'm so sorry about everything. And that got really old pretty quick. So when people would come into the room and treat me as a human being and just, you know, a mom whose son is sick and we're trying to figure out what to do, they would ask me about things going on outside of the hospital. They would ask me how I was doing. Just when they could just interact with me, just treat me normally. I'm a person who has a job outside of here, who has a life outside of here, but right now this is our focus. But just to be not always having someone enter the room. Everyone knew our situation. And so many people would walk into our room with this like hunched over, sad face. I got so tired of that. So it was really helpful to just have people come in, talk to us as we are talking today, present facts, give us all the information, let us know you're giving us all the information so that we have everything we need to make some of these decisions.
What I find is that if there's usually a doter, which is usually the mom. You know, the I can sit here like I'm nesting for days on end, never leave. Then you have the dad, who's the usually someone's the fixer. I've got to fix this. We've got to come to a conclusion. There's a cause and effect. We got to fix something. When I find, like my husband, he's the fixer. So there were times that it was okay to give him permission to leave the room. Go home, pay the bills, go home, do something. And then there was times that it switched and I had to leave the room. I had to leave and take off and go do something that was productive, something that was going to get completed, something that I could do, something I could complete. But there will be some that will never leave, and they'll totally starve to death at the bedside because I can't leave. I'm a horrible person if I leave this bed. So knowing who's in that role and who, where they're at in that moment, as you get to know these families, you'll know what day it is. You'll know when they're ready to talk. You'll know when they're like, I just don't want to talk today. I just can't verbalize it, you know? So, and it's okay. The emotions we experience, I said it's the roller coaster from hell. And you want off. You want off the ride. As you become introduced to this family, each family, you'll get to understand where they're at on that roller coaster. And I think that's important. And giving them, I do it all the time as supervisors, giving them permission. You can sit here, mama, for 12 hours, but you have to eat. You're going to faint. You're going to go down. You're going to faint. And I'm sending you out, for us at Children's, I'm sending you over next door to Grant, or I'm sending you to Riverside. So letting them be conscious that you're helping watch them as well. Because when you get to those hours, nothing else matters. No one else matters. When you're coming down to the line, nothing matters. Eating, talking, nothing. The world stops, even though it's circling around you. So knowing where they are and where they're, and giving them, but if you don't have a relationship, they're not going to let you in at that hour, at that last hour. If you are not already in that little circle as the hours wind down, they're not letting you in because it's just too personal and too raw. So just knowing where they are and how they function, those relationships you've built will help you know how to handle them.
There is going to be multiple different communication styles that you're going to have to develop and engage in over the course of your careers. That's just a blanket statement, and it'll become glaringly obvious to you. There's multiple different styles. I think my family dynamic doesn't sound too different from the Lewis's. I'll give you two examples. The day after Gavin's surgery, where they took out the vast majority of the tumor the first time and were able to test it and determine what type of tumor it was, the very next day, the doctor comes in and gives us the diagnosis. It's ATRT. You've got 3 to 6 months. We're sitting on, I can still picture it today, we're sitting on the couch at Children's. I'm holding my wife, and he's starting out in breaking the news to us. And he's telling us what type of tumor it is. I don't know what atypical teratoid rhabdoid tumor even means. Couldn't spell it. Probably still can't. I don't know what that means. So tell me in English what this means to me. And when he starts going into life expectancy and starts talking about it being terminal, and we've got 3 to 6 months. About halfway through that conversation, my wife is scream crying. You understand the term scream crying? She is screaming and crying at the same time. Hysterical. Not inappropriate, just scream crying. And she probably doesn't want to hear anymore. He could have probably stopped right there. But me, being me, I have to hear it. It's not real. unless I hear it, and I need to know exactly what I'm looking at so that I can make the best educational decision going forward for my family. I have to hear it. And so those types of understanding that you might have to deal with two different dynamics all at the same on the same couch, be prepared for that. Because, as Jenna said, there's going to be one member of the household that communicates one way and another member of the household that communicates a different way. Second example, that day, Gavin came out of surgery. He was in the ICU at Children's, and the resident who had informed me that, after the CT scan, that they had found a mass on his brain, which they had just removed, circled back down after the surgery, just came in the room just to say hello. And as she was in the room and she saw Gavin and he had, the bandage on the back of his head and just looked like he had just came out of brain surgery, she started crying. And, she was young, 20s. She started crying and then she became very apologetic for crying. And I get it. I have family that's in the medical, my mom's been a nurse for 43 years in peds, aunts, cousins. I understand the concept of that professional detachment that you have to have, your bedside manner. But the reality is, if you're not touched by that situation in that room, I would question your personality because that's not human. And so while she was very apologetic for being emotional in the room, I walked out of the room with her and I walked down the hall with her and I just had a conversation with her as, person to person that, listen, don't ever apologize for that. In that moment, we needed reality. I didn't need a robot. I didn't need that robotic doctor, stone face. Her being emotional, her, being able to see that it touched her as a person helped us understand that we weren't alone, that the emotion that we were feeling was not inappropriate because it is real. In that moment, it is reality, and allow yourself to be touched. If you're going into peds or if you're going into palliative care, you have to understand you're making a volunteer decision to go into the final stages of somebody's life. It's going to get real. And so don't be afraid to communicate that you are a real person. It may just help. It may just give that family exactly what they need in that moment.
One more thing I wanted to say about the body. She mentioned the body language, and it was so dead on. They know when you're coming in and you're filling your time and you're marking your check for you've got to talk to this family for the day and write your little assessment note. I experienced as a supervisor and also experienced as a mom. And your body language is everything. When you walk in that room, they know when you're looking at your watch or you're consumed by the buzzing of your phone or your Voceras or whatever devices you have. If you're going in and you need to have a 10-minute conversation, 15, or maybe a 30, be very conscious of those devices because they know when you're being distracted and they know when you're not there, when you're not present in that room. And they'll answer your questions because most of the parents, 90% of the parents are very courteous. So they'll answer your checkbox answers, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. And then there's the sitting down. How are you doing today? Have you eaten? Your body language says everything when you walk in the room and when you're in those parent or those family centered rounds outside their room or wherever it is. So pay attention. And some people are more in tune to the body language than others. I'm with her. I read people every day. And you'll know by their body language if they're receptive to the information you're giving them. So that's huge.
Yeah. One of the things I've been struck listening by, all we were going through this as a part of a unit with spouses, kids, and whatnot. and you've alluded to what that's meant from the team, it may be irrelevant. Like, I'm single. Would it be different for me, or what would you want people to know about what it means, your team, to be dealing with a group and a unit? Is there something you want them to think? Is it harder that you have a spouse to worry about when you're grieving? Is it easier? What can the team learn from that?
So I think it is important to get to know the people that you're working with. For Aaron and I, Keith is our only child. We had been given permission from our employees to drop work and be at the hospital. So our focus was 100% Keith. And we are very different in how we communicate and how we want to talk about things. So I would say just get to know who you're working with. Get to know what that child means to the parent or grandparent or whoever has custody of the child. It could be a number of different situations. So get to know them, I think it's okay to ask about their faith. Our faith was something that was really important to us as we walked through this. I think it's okay to ask, in my opinion, because then that became part of the conversations as well, including our faith and the decisions that we were making.
Yeah, I say it certainly goes back to like just trying to figure out the dynamics, and I like to tell staff that your ability to provide medical care is what I expect of you, and that's kind of like the bar for you to be in the room, right? But your ability to really provide that personal care and make those connections, that's the stuff that we remember. I don't remember who decided to give what drug at what time. I remember who brought us the Subway tray. And I remember a conversation. I remember asking Sam to be our photographer for our baptism. She was a nurse. Because we had conversations about photography, and she's into photography, so we got talking down hours about photography and cameras and stuff. But, that step above providing medical care with the relationships, how you communicate people, how you show that you're human and show emotions, it's those connections that were going to really set you apart from other doctors, you have this ability to provide exceptional medical care, plus you have the a natural ability to connect with people and really share that you care, and that's where you build that trust, and then we can be open with you, and you're going to get so much more out of that relationship and be able to provide so much better care beyond just medical care. And I think that's really where you start to set yourself aside, and that's probably your goal in coming in this profession is not to provide medical care, but to provide personal care to people who are going through difficult situations while underlying providing the best medical care possible. And I always say I'm a little biased, but providing care to folks like us who are losing children, who will lose children, who have lost children, you have the ability to make such a stronger impact in people's lives being in this. It's extremely difficult kind of the world you're going into and the world you're in. But I think the ability to touch people and affect people is way higher than fixing Johnny's broken arm when he's back on the playground tomorrow, right? I'm like, yeah, we went to Children's and like my nephew just got a cast on his arm this week. They went to the doctor, they got a cast. They have no idea who their doctor was. They just went in and got a cast. But 2 years, years and out, we treat these people like family. We love them like family because you're just dealing with people in this such a different situation that you can make this, you have the ability to make this huge impact, and that impact comes above providing medical care.
I have something I wanted to add too. I think it's important to get to know, we get to know the care team from your guys' end, but I think it's important for you to know who the care team is from our end. We had grandparents in our room every day, and maybe you would assume they were part of the care team, but they were not. We love Keith's grandparents dearly, but all of the decisions were being made by Aaron and I. And we would hear the opinions of others. doctors would come in and give them some of the same information, but it was important for the medical staff to know that we were the ones making the decisions, and our feelings and opinions are what mattered for Keith's care.
When we were given January 24th, actually January 23rd has started because they wanted to come in. They saw me late in the day. My husband had already gone away. And they're like, hey, Janice, we got some pretty big information for you. You ready? I'm like, you know, I need to have this information with my family. I don't need this information. I could read their faces. It's so powerful. It's gonna change my family. And I need the most important people around me when you give me this information. I love you for wanting to come right here and give it to me, but I need you to wait. Can you do it tomorrow morning? Can we do it tomorrow? Yes. I'm going to bring my son, my daughter, because Luke was the youngest, and my husband. And the four of us need to be there together. We have to be there together. I didn't want them to give me information. And I think as an employee of the hospital, they were super, at one point my husband really thought that they were secretly giving me information they weren't giving him. And it wasn't the truth. He was so funny. And he felt that way probably for the first month. He goes, Janice, are they telling you stuff they're not telling me? I'm like, no, baby, I'm telling you, promise you that they're giving us both information. But we absorb it differently. Two people can interpret the information differently, but it was important to me. So you might want to ask your family, we have some really heavy information for you. Is there someone else you need in the room with you when we give you this information? You know, you will have some decisions to make at that time. And Luke was not coherent. He couldn't be a part. We didn't have it in the room because he was at that point in an induced coma because of the seizures. So yes, is it harder? I, at least on this end, I can't tell you there's not a day that goes by that I wonder if they're doing okay. And I think they are. And then one day I noticed that it happened with my daughter first. She got mad about something, and my daughter's so even keeled and really, she's 21 now, really cool kid, but just exaggerated this response that I'm like, Katie, are you okay? And it was about her phone, and it all happened to be because her brother, because he's a prankster just like his little brother, he threw water and didn't realize that it hit her phone, and she was petrified all those pictures of Luke would be gone. She couldn't articulate that. She just got mad. And then it happened to my son the same way, just not even 2 weeks later. He had he got angry over something really dumb and was just, he walked home from the store, which he never does. It was like 3 miles. He needed to do that. So yes, am I always concerned about my crew? We have family that's not from here. So we are transplanted from another state. So the only core family that I have here is my husband and my two children. So yes, we are constantly thinking about them and their well-being. And even now how are you doing? What have you? And I just last night, we're 5 months, almost 6 months into this. And my 26-year-old came home with a fabric dinosaur head. You know, those T-Rex heads at Walmart. Proud as a peacock. Look, Mom, look what I found. Because Luke was a jokester and he would pull out his T-Rex jokes at any point in time, along with the your mom was so fat jokes. And I'm like, Luke. So for him, he needed that dinosaur head to laugh and have some. And so I know he's dealing with the goodbye. And Katie did the same thing last week. She came home as proud as could be. She's like, look what I found, Mom. And it was a white T-Rex cookie jar at Target. But those are how they remember Luke. And that's exactly. And he would do that all the time. So yes, on this end, we are constantly concerned about our network, our team. And not every family is built like that. It might be just two. It might be just one. It might be the one person alone sitting at the bedside because the illness has been so long, everyone else is gone. So knowing who is important for them, or even asking them to pull in the extra people
when they're facing these things? Do you have someone else that you need to have with you as we give you and disseminate this information to you?
Yeah, I don't really know how to answer your question because my situation was just my situation. And so everybody's reality is different. I've got a large family, you know, and so it was always, that was just my reality. And so when we were going through the process, you know, my concern was always for my wife and for my children, even at the expense of my own. You know, it was always, are they doing okay? I think Aaron hit a very valid point for you all that I want to hammer home. The minimum expectation from you all as doctors is to provide the medical care to our children, to us as people. Let me give you an analogy from my world. If I were to do your taxes and just simply fill out the 1040 and just do your taxes, I can do that. That's the minimum expectation. I can fill out your taxes and file them with whatever situation you are living in your world. But if I don't look at your situation and tell you, here are some instances, here's some situations where you could actually lower your tax liability, you know, or save on your tax payments, then I'm not doing my full job. Just fathom that for a second. I file your taxes, I see where you could save some money on taxes, and I don't tell you. That's the equivalent of providing the medical care to our children, but not looking at the overall situation of how do I care for them as people as well. On the flip side of that, we're real. We understand you're people too. You have your own lives. There are going to be days where your families, your life situations don't induce a bubbly personality walking in that room. And that's okay. Just don't make that the norm. Understand that we understand that you have lives and that sometimes things are going to happen in your lives that cause you to mentally be somewhere else. Be cognizant of that when you walk in those rooms, because what you do matters to the people in those rooms.
Sure. After the loss of your son, how did you perceive, like, the palliative care team or hospital staff sending cards, coming to wakes, funerals, things like that? Because I've always kind of heard different things from different people. Does it make it easier? Does it make it harder? Is it a reminder of, you know, hospital staff coming to this, you know, private? So
I think it goes back to knowing the family and knowing, trying to determine what they might want. For us, like we've all said, they were all family to us. They were the ones who saved our child at one point when he had a code blue. They were the ones we lived with. We never left the hospital. So we had a few staff members come to Keith's celebration of life, and we enjoyed having them there. It kind of brought Keith back to us. You know, when you have a child who has passed away, especially at a young age, when you're around people who knew your child, it's really powerful. We have so many people in our lives that unfortunately didn't even get to meet Keith. So when we had what I would call family there, family from the hospital, it was really powerful for us.
But at the same time, we realize that you're in this profession and you see this over and over, right? So we also appreciate and understand and respect that, you know, if you went to every funeral of every family that passed away, that would be your job, right? That's 50% of your job or whatever. So we certainly we're not hurt in a negative way by some people that didn't come that we thought we were really close to. because we understand, like, if I was in that position, I probably couldn't come. We had one nurse who we asked to be with us on the last day, and she had a daughter the same age as Keith, and she's like, you know, Keith reminds me of my daughter, you know, just telling little stories and stuff. So we said, we really love this nurse, and we wanted her to be with us on the last day, but I'm not sure we should even ask her, because she has a daughter. How hard is that on her? And I asked her, and she said, I'd be honored to. I was like, wow. You know, so, but we understand that you go through this over and over and over, so it's okay if you attend the funeral. It's okay if you don't, you know, if you have something going on in your life, but there's probably going to be those special people and special families that you meet throughout your career that you're like, this one, I'll go to the funeral. And don't feel bad that you don't go to other funerals, but you just have to make that personal choice and realize that, you know, some, like, you may never want to go to anybody's funeral because it's just too difficult and, you know, you want, you know, whatever personal decision that is for you, that's fine. You may go to 25% of the funerals. I don't know, and it's okay either way. But you need to make that decision for you and how that affects you personally and allows you to do your job. We never took it personally that you detached from us. I would say I don't know how they could even do that job per day. You know, so anything above that was just, you know, amazing to us. But that's just a decision you have to make. And it doesn't have to be, it needs to be kind of for each family or whatever. But there are probably going to be those families where you really attach to and you want to go to the funeral. And that's okay.
100% agree. I'm not offended. I wasn't offended. When you spend that much time in the hospital, we see hundreds of personnel. So we understand that actually the celebration services would be packed with just hospice personnel if everyone came. And again, it's not offensive either way. It is an honor to have you have someone come, but we totally get it if you can't and if you choose not to. And it's always harder when you have a family member of the same age of the person who's passing, or they remind you of someone. If it gets a little too close and it gets harder, it is impossible to care for human beings. And with every passing that you bond with families, it takes a piece of your heart. And there comes a time where you have to say, I can't do that today. And it's okay. And it's not offensive. It's actually, like he said, an honor that anyone comes. And it is an honor to be treated with such respect and care when they were alive. So either way.
When a child loses their parents, the term is orphan. When a spouse loses their significant other, the term is a widow. There is no term in the English language for a parent who has lost their child. It's just not something that we conceive. So there is no protocol for how to react to that situation. I have nothing else to add. I think they said we appreciated the ones that came and the ones that contacted us afterwards, and we still keep in contact with them today. They helped in the moments that was necessary, but we hold no thoughts or no ill will. If you can make it, great. If not, we understand.
One thing I forgot to mention, one of your greatest fears as a parent when you lose a child is that everyone will forget that they came. There's some people that die when they're 90. Everyone knew them. But when they just visited us for a short time, your biggest fear is that everyone forget they existed. And the ones left to remember are the ones that were closest. And you're just left. You're never the same. You're different. You're just never the same. So when it comes to parents, just like he said, it is weird that there's no term for the loss of a child. That there's no there's, because that shouldn't happen. We're horrible in America addressing child deaths. We're getting better,
It's horrible that we're getting better at it, but we have to. But it is powerful nonetheless.
Question? Yeah, I have a question for you, and I just want to say thank you so much for your vulnerability and sharing. So each one of you has experienced a wonderful relationship, many wonderful relationships, I hear, and then suddenly it's all over, and you're left bereft. So there is a term, you are bereft, or bereaved. But that's just common, yes?
Right.
What's it been like being bereft, and how important has support been in the process after the death? And I really mean not just the moments after and not the funeral, but beyond. So I hear each one of you in a different space of vulnerability of, oh my gosh, I lost this relationship I love so much. Could you speak a little bit about bereavement support?
Well, that's a heavy question. life changes dramatically. We're at the age where all of our friends are having children and multiple children and having birthday parties. So we dealt with a lot of our friends kind of stiff-arming us. They didn't know what to do with us. We've lost some friendships. Relationships with family members have been tough because people just don't know what to do with us. We don't know what to do with ourselves either. But for us, it's been really important that we find a way to keep parenting Keith. Even though he's not here, what does our role as parents look like now? He is our only child. So we really had a lot of issues with identity crisis. You know, we would go out to dinner on Father's Day, and we would hear people telling other families, oh, happy Father's Day, happy Father's Day. And it would make me upset that no one's telling Aaron because we don't have our child with us. So it was just finding a way that we could still be looked at as parents. And obviously this is a really good way. We're very involved at Children's. We do a number of things to keep Keith's legacy alive. So for us, it's just been trying to figure out how we do this, I guess.
Yeah, your relationships certainly change. And, you know, support. We find great support in talking to other families who have lost children. You know, there's just this instant connection and bond with people like this who there's things we don't have to say, and there's things that we can say between us that I probably wouldn't say, maybe in front of you guys, you're trained for it, but that I wouldn't say in front of our family members. You know, things are like, man, that's really inappropriate and that's crazy, you know. But there's just things we can say between us that, you know, so that comfort, I think, meeting other families who have lost children, that being around them, I think, is really comforting because we're just all in that same boat together. It's a horrible club to be in, but we didn't choose it. But there's comfort in that club. You know, we do a lot at Children's. We've started a nonprofit, a 501c3, donating blankets to the hospital. We've met families through that. You know, so we know families benefit from that. And we've benefited from that, and it's all about really keeping Keith's name alive. And it's really hard to tell your family and friends, like, we love hearing Keith's name. We love stories about him because it's almost more awkward for them to talk about it than it is awkward for us not to hear about it, you know. And that's been really frustrating. We've struggled with that, you know. So we were on a walk with our dogs and my mom and my brother and his kids. And, you know, they started talking to some random person in the neighborhood because they're my mom's son. But like, how many kids do you have? How many grandkids do you have? You know, and she said 6 or whatever it was at the time. I'm like, well, you actually have 7. You know, I could tell instantly, you know, Rachel was like, it really affected us. It was like, what the hell, you know? Like, this is my mom. And I'm getting darts from her. Like, she's ready to, you know, attack. And I'm like, calm down. So we address it that night, you know. We said, there's something we want to talk about before he left. And she knew. I didn't know how to answer it. I said, he's your grandson. You have 7 now, you know. But, you know, she was just nervous to say, oh, I have 7. But one's passed. You didn't have to say, I have 7, but one's dead. You just have 7. You know, that person didn't know the difference. There weren't 6 of the grandkids there. It wasn't like you said seven, I'm counting. Like, that wasn't the situation. But it's just like, you know, and there's sometimes when people ask us, like, you know, do you have any children? I judge a situation, and, you know, I would say, you know, no, I don't. And then, like, 10 minutes later, I'm like, sorry, buddy. Like, you know, but it just wasn't, I just, you know, some of you just don't want to deal with it. It's just awkward. It's more awkward for them than it is for me, right? I love talking about him. I love saying his name. But it gets really awkward for the people you're talking to, and they don't know what to say. They don't know how to react. You know, so it is the grieving process is really difficult, and it's really difficult to grieve along with others who don't know how to deal with you and don't know what to say. And I always say afterward, there's nothing you're going to say. There's no pot of lasagna that's going to make this any better or and make it any worse than it is. Yeah, like we're at the bottom, so you're not going to make it worse. So say something, acknowledge it, and that's what really means a lot to us. I don't care what you say, but ignoring it and not talking about it makes it way worse. And people don't know how to deal with that. People don't want to deal with that. And we see that all the time. We have pictures of our son at our desk at work, and people come up and say, oh, you have a son? Like, yeah, we do, and he passed away, you know, 2 years ago. And they just like, oh, go, it's like, oh, well, see, have a nice day. See you later. You know, it's like, where'd you go? Yeah, so it's really difficult. We struggle between us, you know. Not between us, but, you know, we struggle individually and together at home. And, you know, we have nights where we cry and stuff. But I think really the harder thing is dealing with other people. Yeah. And other people dealing with other people dealing with us. Because, you know, because we're weird.
It is true. We do enjoy talking about our kids, and people are so afraid of the tears. Don't be afraid of the tears. I can tell you it's so good when they want to hear about Luke, because he was real and he was crazy. And anyone who knew him, they'll come up. I love it when they say, you know, I was missing Luke today. I'm like, yeah, what prompted that thought? You know, and we'll talk about it, because he was so crazy. He was absolutely ridiculously crazy, almost to the point that it was almost wrong. That at times matter of fact, he was coming out of one of his sedations, and he was being extubated and coming off all of his drips. And I'm like, if he starts with the yo mama jokes and I'm not here, I need you to shut him down. And lo and behold, I'm on the couch, and he starts talking, and he starts whipping out these yo mama jokes with the staff. I'm like, Lucas Benjamin, no, not here. And so it feels good to say, you know, I went by and I thought of them today. I thought of Keith today. I thought of your child. And I've now, since other parents who have had their children pass, I go up to them and tell them how sorry I am that I never told them how much I thought of their child. So one thing, talk about them. And if you're counseling other people who are in the periphery, because we don't teach each other what to do, teach them it's okay to talk about the child that has passed. And I do, I'm the same way. How many children do you have? I have three. One's waiting on the other side for me. He left a little early, but he's still waiting. Forever, he'll be 17 in my mind. He'll never age. His friends are going on. That is hard. And the bereft, it feels like a raft. The word bereft feels like a raft on a waterway. And that you feel that way at times, that you're just out there just waiting. Because people are really weird now. They're weird when they talk to you. And the whole reason we come here is to help, so that other parents, you know, hopefully 10 years from now, it's not going to be as awkward. I would like to believe it'll be all fixed. But hopefully as we do this, it becomes easier to have them talk about their child, and all the things they miss, because we do enjoy talking about our children.
Very much so. We still talk about Gavin in our house every day. And the reality is, when you're in the moment for our 6 month, you know, from diagnosis to passing, and then in the immediate months following, there's an onslaught of people, family, neighbors, friends. I can't tell you how many lasagnas we got. And I love food, but I'm Italian. I had to step away from the lasagna for a minute. But then all of a sudden, something happens, and everybody goes away. It stops. And then there's a transition to exactly like they said. Now all of a sudden, nobody really understands how to deal with you, you know, how to talk about the situation. And that's an awkward moment. But here's the way I look at it from our experience, you know, and I want to take a second, to talk about regret. Regret is an animal that will eat you alive if you let it. Regret is a terrible thing. Maybe the worst of things. You know, regret is the kind of thing that would tear families apart in our situations. You know, one parent wants to go one direction with treatment. The other parent wants to go another direction. There's some question about, you know, the care, whatever. I truly believe that the greatest gift my family was given by our palliative care team was the ability to live the rest of our lives with no regrets. We have no regrets. Gavin was given the best care, the best love, had the best death, and overall just made the best out of the most god-awful situation possible. We have no regrets. The day that my wife and I found out that Gavin's tumor was going to take him from us, I told my wife I didn't think I could have any more children. We were standing in one of the atriums. It was about 3 a.m. in one of the atriums at Children's, and we couldn't sleep. We had walked down to the subway down in the basement, and at 3 a.m. I told my wife I didn't think I could have any more children. I just couldn't rationalize the possibility of this happening again. I've had three beautiful daughters since Gavin passed. And every once in a while, I'll stop and I'll look at my daughters and I'll just think about what our lives would look like without them in it. Ladies and gentlemen, that would have been regret. That would have been regret. Here's where you all come in. Ready? These three little girls only exist in this world because we were able to pick up and carry on following Gavin's passing. We were able to pick up and carry on because of the support circle that we had in place when he passed. That's what you all are doing here today. You are, by being here today, by going into the profession that you're going into, you are forming that support circle for that next family like ours. I love that this is an educational environment, but I don't want you to lose sight of the fact that what you're doing here today matters. Because what that palliative care team that is right now at 9:40 in the morning standing in somebody's house or standing in somebody's room, what that team does matters. Go forth, do what you're going to do. Understand the importance of what you're doing, because going forward, you're going to be involved in a team that at some point is going to matter immensely to somebody.
I loved how you put it. What you're doing is the CPR for the emotional healing of a family after they say goodbye. It's not something that's on a billboard. It's not an algorithm you see in a training film. You are giving CPR for the healing of their emotions and given them permission to proceed. And it's so important. We are not really good at it yet. We're getting better, and that's why there's classes like this. And that's why we felt important to come, and that I felt I had to come. Luke would absolutely be so thrilled to know that someone else's family will be changed because of how you're going to enter their room.
Any other?
How does losing a child affect your marriage and your other close relationships with your kids, with your parents? How did it affect your lives?
Go ahead.
So just like when Keith was here, it just forces us to have those conversations. We've had conversations with other couples about, you know, we buried Keith and we also bought our plots right next to it. It's not something you're supposed to do in your 30s, but it's something that we did. So for us, it has really brought us a lot closer. We've been through a lot as a couple even before Keith was born. So we are good communicators, and surprisingly, this made us better communicators. It just brought us closer. Certainly, there were times where he was on one end and I was on the other, but we respected that. So something I always say is we meet each other every day as grieving parents who have lost their child. I'm not trying to fix him. He's not trying to fix me. We allow each other to have the emotion that we need to, and I deal with my grief very differently than he deals with his grief. He's extremely extroverted, if you weren't able to tell. I'm extremely introverted. So things that exhaust me don't necessarily exhaust him. So we just really have to respect each other as we'll continue to grieve our entire lives. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'll just add, we had a lot of conversations around, you know, she would say, "You're doing so much better than I am." You know, like she would be crying every day and, you know, I would kind of, you know, going about my life, whatever. And then there was days where, you know, where I would cry and she wouldn't. And it was, you know, I had to tell her a lot, like, this, there's no playbook for this. There's not a playbook for this. And we're both doing, and whatever we're doing is okay and is right. I say a lot, like, if we went and sat in our basement for 6 months and didn't come out, people would be like, yeah, they're in their basement. Their kid died. They're in their basement. And they think that's okay, you know? And that would be okay. But I always, you know, said to Rachel and said to myself, what would Keith want from us? What would he want me to do if he could talk? And it's not sit in the basement for 6 months. It's getting out there, moving on with your life, doing things to honor him. That's why we're so involved with children. Like, children's is our home almost as much as, you know, we are children for two of his 6 months. So it's almost as much as our home with him as our house is, you know. So we are involved with a lot of children's. You know, we do these panels with, this is great. We do this for Keith, you know. And our charity, we do our charities work. You know, sometimes I wish to hell I didn't have a call. I wish I didn't have a charity. I don't want a charity for my kid who's passed away. But we're in the situation, and that's what I have to do for him. It's all about his legacy, and, you know, I think, what would he want me to be doing? And stuff like this.
My husband and I are married 27 years already when Luke passed. We already had an established relationship, but I can tell you it challenged us to a level. I saw things about my husband I never knew. I always knew he was a good guy. I had no idea how good of a guy he was. I didn't know how strong we were until we went through this. I had no clue whatsoever. And now, even now, we have the same conversations. I'll be on the couch and someone will send me a picture on Facebook and I'm, you know, sobbing. I'm a crybaby. I cry all the time. Please forgive me. I'm a tree hugger and a crybaby. I'm an extrovert. I cry all the time. And he's like, "What happened?" "Nothing." And it just happened last week. He goes, "I don't cry as much." And my comment was, "I wish I didn't cry as much." I said, "You're lucky." But again, allowing the couple to, and a lot of times it does split you up. I see why people divorce. I see why people hide away and pick up and move. And unlike them, they bury their child and bought plots. We're at a place where we're getting ready to retire down the road, a few more years down the road, 10, 15. And we're not convinced we're going to stay in Ohio. And none of our family's here. So we giggle about it now because we did have him cremated. And none of our family understood that. They're like, "What were you thinking? And again, we would say, why would you say that horrible thing to me? But I didn't. I said, because what if we move away and he's here alone? And I couldn't stand the thought of him being in Ohio without us. So my husband and I, again, Luke was hysterical and makes us laugh about everything. We have determined first one down gets Luke. So whoever dies first gets Luke. Whoever gets planted first is going to get Luke next to them. So we can giggle about that. That is comforting to us. I know that I don't have to exhume his body to take him to wherever I'm going to move. If I choose to move out of state, it is a very big possibility I'll stay here in Ohio. But I see why people are dissected during grief, because it is so awkward. I think even more so than when a grandparent or a parent or an expected end happens. And the word cancer automatically throws everything, but with us, it wasn't cancer until the last day, the last 24, it wasn't even 24 hours we had that diagnosis. So everyone's weird. Everyone's weird. All of Luke's friends are graduating this year and next year. Everyone is really crazy about it. And they avoid you like you have the plague. And they do have that puppy dog look. Oh, I'm so sorry. I know. It's okay. I'm working through it. It's funny, but it does dissect families on a regular basis, and helping them. I think the aftercare is important to help the nucleus family or whoever's in their periphery to help them orchestrate through that, because it can be very overwhelming.
My wife and I had a really solid marriage before this all went down. We had a phenomenal marriage when it was done, to be honest with you. And it's just not something that came into our head. We were told after the fact, you know, months down the road, some astronomical divorce rate between parents in a situation like this. And it just blew what little hair I have, you know, back, because it never even entered our consciousness. We became closer in the situation because we were so in lockstep with all the decisions. But we also, he's buried over in Powell, and we've got our plots right next to him. Like Aaron said, you want to talk about being a part of a club that nobody ever wanted to sign up for. We have our plots already paid for, you know, in our 30s, right next to our son. And so it's just, it's our reality.
Thank you guys so much. I am just going to close and summarize, if that's okay, for the sake of time, because I know we could probably talk all day with questions, because you guys are so helpful. But wanted to just hope that you guys get a lot out of this and that you can take this with you as you go forward with your rotations and things like that. But in summary, what we need to realize is that the role of a parent making decisions for a child with life-threatening condition requires definitely a very unique set of skills. Hopefully you can tell that they've expressed between a parent and a palliative care provider, and also emphasize that the journey for a bereaved parent is distinct amongst grieving individuals, and I think that they've done a really great job of expressing that without even knowing that that was one of our objectives in coming to talk today. Thank you, everybody, for your time, and thank you guys also for sharing your stories and being so vulnerable.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.